So for people who were in the talk this morning at 11, this talk, at least from my perspective, not necessarily the papers we wrote, but my perspective, is kind of the reverse. Because in that talk, the fluid part of it, this field theory part of it, was kind of seen as primary, and we were looking at the gravitational things that resulted from that. In this case, at least for me, because I'm the relativist, I'm more interested in the gravity side and seeing what happens over on the fluid side. And I guess in particular, what we're interested in, there's several, some problems that show up in gravity that at least it seems might be resolved if you looked at the fluid side, or possibly some problems that show up in on the fluid side that might be resolvable if you look at the gravity side instead. And so we're sort of looking here at what, if you sort of take both sides of them completely seriously, and you take the physics of both sides of them completely seriously, you want to see what the physics on the gravity side may say about interpretations of fluid and vice versa. And in particular, I guess what we're interested in is black holes and entropy. And so for a black hole in equilibrium, it's this pretty much universally agreed notion of the entropy, which is proportional to the area divided by 4. And so there's no disagreement about that. Pretty much all calculations that have ever been done, right, based partly because everyone already knew what answer they wanted, but for all calculations that have ever been done get this to the lowest order. Maybe there's corrections to it, and it's pretty much everyone agrees that the entropy of a black hole is proportional to to the area, and in particular a quarter of the area, if you end up setting all these constants to 1. So then the more complicated situation, though, is if you've got a non-equilibrium black hole, which of course most black holes would be, right? It'd be pretty rare to see something that's completely in equilibrium. And in that case, if you're still thinking about entropy, there's several questions you can ask. The first one is the entropy even still well defined? Because once you leave equilibrium, you're kind of going into the regime of non-equilibrium thermodynamics or statistical mechanics. And if you're far from equilibrium, it's not clear that your entropy will even still be well defined. But you sort of expect in some quasi-equilibrium regime, entropy would be well defined. And that's, of course, the regime that we work in when we're doing, when we do undergraduate thermodynamics. We're sort of usually in sort of quasi-equilibrium, quasi-static regime, and there entropy is assumed to be well defined. So, yeah. If it is well defined, one could wonder, is it still proportional to the horizon area? So even if we all agree that the static case or the stationary case is proportional to the horizon area, is it still proportional to the horizon area in dynamical situations? And most people sort of assume it is, but that, of course, is something that is just sort of an assumption. Because of all the calculations, the loop quantum gravity and the string theory calculations all work with stationary or static black holes. And if it is proportional to the horizon, your sort of tertiary question there would be, which horizon? Because, of course, when you're in equilibrium and in a static situation, all notions of horizon, sort of killing horizon, event horizon, apparent horizon, anything like this, they all pretty much agree. If you're in a dynamical situation, they disagree. So what I'm going to do talk about first, and so from one of the kind of the goals of this project was to sort of try to understand whether there's anything about that the fluid gravity correspondence could tell us about resolving these issues of resolving these issues of horizons and entropy. Okay. So first, as kind of leading up into that, we'll just go back and review what we know about horizons in classical GR. And so we have our kind of standard picture here, where this is sort of Eddie Finkelstein type coordinates, and we've got this is basically a Vidya solution. This actually is a maple plot of some part of a Vidya solution. So you have your singularity at r equals 0. Your v equals constant slices are going up here, are going horizontal. And so in this picture, what you have is this here is the mass, is the matter coming in. So it's a Vidya solution, so it's null dust falling in. And it's actually continuous, continuous and smooth, but we just sort of see it ramps up pretty quickly here, right? So you have a bunch of matter falls in along here, and it causes this growth in the horizons. So first, we're going to think about what event horizons do in these dynamic situations. So event horizons, of course, locally, they're null hypersurfaces, and they're ruled by null geodesics. But of course, event horizons are teleological, right? They're defined by what happens in the future. So an event horizon is sort of the last surface that doesn't escape to infinity. Right? It kind of gets caught on the horizon instead. So let's look at this situation here. Here we have space-time. Basically, nothing's happening. The shell of matter is way far out here. You're coming along, and you look at your null geodesics, right? So you've got this one that appears to be your event horizon at this stage. You've got a bunch of things that are going in, right? Those are inside. This is r equals 2m, right? This is a bunch of things going out. And you sort of think, well, if nothing's happening here, this is our event horizon all the way up here. But in fact, what happens is when your pulse of matter arrives, what looks like your event horizon gets sucked into the black hole. And so that wasn't your event horizon, so I label it your false event horizon. And in fact, what the true event horizon is one of these guys, and you can't really tell it, but one of these guys that appeared to be escaping, but then as he was escaping, the shell of matter come by, caught it, and that ended up being the event horizon. And your only way to determine where the real event horizon is by its ultimate fate. And so that's the teleological thing. So all of these, and this is something that often gets a little bit confused in discussing it, but all of these event horizons, they're null surfaces, and so they are evolving kind of causally and locally, and everything's just a null surface following regular null dynamics governed by these equations, right? They're kind of the Ray-Chaudhry equations. But what happens is, in order to figure out which surface you're talking about, you have to use your future boundary conditions. There are some circumstances where this starts to look like a local equation, and identifying things looks like a local equation. I actually will see these, but these are special circumstances. Ultimately, you always need to know some information about the future. I guess it turns out that if you know that your horizon is always going to be slowly expanding, I'll kind of quantify what that means, you can also sort of locate where the event horizon is likely to be. But basically, you still need, that's still future information. Okay, so that's event horizons. So, you know, so that's sort of the default position. Now, there's all the classical theorems about event horizons, the area theorem, the theorem that, you know, they're not going to divide in half. But then you also have apparent horizons. So apparent horizons gets used to mean several different things that are all closely related, but we're going to kind of use the sort of the colloquial definition of an apparent horizon. So it's a hypersurface foliated with surfaces of vanishing outward null expansion. So outward null expansion, we'll call it theta L, and that's going to be zero, right? So that means that your rays that you think are going radially outwards, you send them out, and then the area never grows, because what's happening is the thing is sitting on the, here's our apparent horizon, the thing is sitting on the horizon, right? It's not expanding, it just kind of stays stationary. Now, these can be quasi-locally identified, so you don't need to go into the future to identify an apparent horizon, or a trapping horizon, whatever you want to call it, and they have local dynamics, and it's governed by this equation, which obviously is more complicated than the Ray-Chaudhry equation, but it's essentially the equivalent equation. So if we have theta L equals zero, then this term is zero, this term is zero, and basically what you do is if your tangent vector, which is this guy, V equals L minus CN, it's the evolution vector, you got your L is your outward null normal, N is your inward null normal, this C will then characterize its evolution, and you get it by solving this partial differential equation. So that's all very well, these things are locally identified, and if we see its dynamics here, right, our event horizon, of course, in some sense, started expanding in advance in anticipation of the matter falling in, whereas the apparent horizon sits there and does nothing until their matter arrives, then it expands, and once the matter has stopped, then it just continues on, right? It stopped expanding. So the apparent horizon is sort of behaving in a way that you'd expect. It expands when things are falling in, it doesn't expand when things aren't falling in, as opposed to the event horizon, which expanded in advance. In some sense. The problem with apparent horizons, so lots of people like them for this reason, and think that these may be actually the ones that kind of reveal physical degrees of freedom, but they're not unique. And basically it's because this equation, essentially what happens if I scaled my null vectors different ways, then all of these quantities would change, and when I solve this PDE for C, I would get different answers, and they wouldn't correspond to those evolutions. That's one way of looking at it. They're not rigid, these guys. The other way of looking at it, and this is sort of easier to see, but it's not quite so obvious how it relates to this equation, is an apparent horizon in the classical definition. You take a hypersurface, so a t equals constant slice, apparent in some sense, right? You look for all the trapped surfaces on that hypersurface. So those are ones where both the outward and inward expansion is negative. You take the union of all those, and you actually have to take the closure of that union, and then you take the boundary of that, and that gives you your apparent horizon on that slice. And you do it for a bunch of slices, and that tells you where your horizon is at each point in time. Now, pretty clearly, if you people often say that these are foliation dependent. What they mean by that is if you tip your foliation, so you take this guy and you turned it, you would sample a different set of trapped surfaces. And so perhaps it's not surprising that this would result in the apparent horizon moving around. So these are not unique. They behave locally, but they're not unique. They're not rigid. There is a regime, and because we're going to be talking about quasi-equilibrium states, there is a regime where things are better, and it's sort of the quasi-equilibrium regime. So it turns out that you can actually characterize what it means for an apparent horizon to be slowly evolving. And essentially what it comes down to, it's not completely obvious from what I've got written here, but essentially what it comes down to is an apparent horizon that's dynamical will always be space-like. And if you take the rate of change of the area along that surface relative to the unit length in that direction, then if that quantity is small, that turns out to be geometrically varying and well-defined thing, and it tells you when the thing is. If it's small, it tells you it's slowly evolving. So that's essentially what's been happening there. Right, I've got Li V, that's the unit vector in the V direction. If that's small, it defines our quantity epsilon. Well, maybe that, no, yeah, that's right. So in that case, the first law holds, which is what you expect, because in if you're thinking back to thermodynamics again, and you have your TdS equals D and work terms, right? That sort of holds, and when we're working in thinking about thermodynamics and undergraduate thermodynamics, that's all in the quasi-equilibrium regime, right? And so that's sort of where you expect the first law to hold, and indeed it does. So what happens in the quasi-equilibrium regime? So we have these guys, and it turns out that let's go back to the event horizon first. In the quasi-equilibrium regime for event horizons, which you can also characterize, this term basically vanishes. Becomes lower order. This term becomes lower order, and you basically get the kappa theta L, which is the expansion of the event horizon. Kappa dA essentially is equal to these shear terms and these work terms, right? Because that's zero, right? So if kappa dA is equal to work from gravitational waves coming in plus energy from matter falling in. If you look in the apparent horizon case, then this term is, we can get rid of those terms. Some of those terms are zero because theta L is equal to zero. And basically all of these terms end up being small, and you again reduce down to the Li L theta L, which is that guy again. And so that's, it sort of all reduces down to this case. And so in those cases, you have a sort of a first law holding for both of them. And it also turns out, and so this is some work I did with an undergrad, and Alex Nielsen at the same time was working on the same thing, it turned out. In this kind of near equilibrium regime, it seems quite likely that hasn't been proved for sure yet, but I think it seems intuitively clear and probably, and it's almost certainly true, that the apparent horizons and the event horizons are always going to be close together. And that's what we see here. The event horizon is that blue guy on the outside, which you can barely see, and the apparent horizon is the black guy, and what we have here is matter that's sort of falling in slowly, right? So the density of the matter falling in is sort of proportional to the color. Sorry? Yeah, so I guess so let's just think about how that, so I think what we think is the case is if you have an apparent horizon which you found by some method or other, then you can probably show there's always an event horizon just outside of it. But if you've done some kind of really crazy slicing so you can't find your apparent horizon, you know, the event horizon is still there, it's just that you can't see it. Is that okay? Yeah?
I believe in that case, can't find the apparent horizon, there's still other surfaces that do exist, called marginal surfaces, for example, where some of the apparent horizon conditions don't hold, but others do.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm actually being pretty sloppy here, right? I'm using apparent horizon in the colloquial sense, which sort of includes marginally trapped surfaces and dynamical horizons and all that kind of stuff. I'm just smudging all that together. Oh yes, no, you're right. Yeah, so I guess like Keith said, yeah, so. Yeah, so that's a good point, though. So really apparent horizons, you need to have that slicing of space-time, and then you find them, right? Like Eric's saying there, right, if you have, you can sort of look for those marginally trapped surfaces and construct things that way. And that's what we're saying here. And when you look for them that way, yeah, well, I'll just leave it there. There's lots of stuff there. Okay. So we'll just go on. So that's just sort of a review of horizons and the problem that arises, right? So if you're really sort of thinking about entropy and how it works, then this probably isn't actually a a question for classical GR. Because of course classical GR doesn't, it doesn't sort of actually have temperature. It's only once you go and sort of do starting quantum field theory and curved space time that you get it. So it's probably a sort of argument about the number of angels on top of a pinhead if you're using classical GR to try to figure out whether the horizon is the apparent horizon or the event horizon, or even what it means for the entropy and dynamical situations. So then one chance you might have if you're trying to avoid actually doing any hard quantum calculations is maybe the fluid gravity correspondence, which we're going to talk about now, will give you an alternate perspective which might help you out on this. So in the fluid gravity correspondence, of course, you have these fluids where you have these entropy flows, and you can talk about their temperature, and you talk about the thermodynamics of the fluid. And so the hope might be that if you have, you can look at the thermodynamics in the fluid and see what it tells you about the horizons, and maybe you would even hope, it turns out it'll be a hope that's not going to be realized, that it might tell you that, oh, you actually are supposed to use the apparent horizon, or oh, you're supposed to use the event horizon, and it sort of settles this question. So let's just think about first, what is the fluid? And so a lot of these questions, for people who were in the talk this morning, a lot of this issue was, a lot of these things were addressed already. And one of the nice things is, so I'm not actually going to top it in the details of how these perturbative calculations, these perturbative solutions get calculated, but they're basically essentially the same as in the talk this morning. Okay, so let's just think about what a fluid is. So a fluid is a thing with the stress energy tensor where you have an energy density times the evolution vector plus a pressure. That's a perfect fluid, right? And this is a transverse to the direction of evolution. And so we have energy density, we have the pressure, and U is our velocity field. If you're near equilibrium fluid and is not a near equilibrium kind of almost perfect fluid, you can allow temperature. So I guess these are equations of state, right? The energy density is a function of temperature. The pressure is a function of temperature. Temperature, of course, is different from the stress energy tensor. They're both T, but one of them is indices. In a near equilibrium fluid, you would have the temperature varying slowly through the fluid, and you would have your evolution vector slowly varying through the fluid. And slowly means relative to sort of the energy scale involved. And if you do that, then you will generally have and we're going to sort of a near perfect fluid, you'll also have some lower order terms. So that was a big pie in the talk this morning, right? And these are like viscosity and things like this. So you have this plus correction terms, which are going to be smaller than these guys. Conservation of energy momentum means that we want this to hold, right? So this is your usual conservation of energy momentum. And when you read these fluid gravity papers, whenever people talk about Navier-Stokes, they mean this. They mean this equation here, which of course Navier-Stokes derives from it, right? But then you also have an entropy current associated with this, right? Because you've got energy changing, so you're going to expect some entropy, and you've got work being done, so you're going to expect some entropy changes to happen. And it turns out that, the entropy current is also primarily sort of in the direction of the evolution vector, and you also have some dissipative terms. So you think of the dissipative terms as kind of as the work terms, right, which are driving entropy. Growth, and the entropy current, it depends exactly on the model that you're using. It's not like you can't derive it, there's no unique way to derive it. It depends on the exact details of the model, but you want it to be increasing, right? So you want it to have non-zero divergence. So the particular type of conformal fluids that we're going to be interested in are trace-free conformal fluids. And so the perfect fluid is trace-free if the trace, as you'd expect, if the trace is zero, which gives you a relationship between the energy density and the pressure. And it's conformally invariant if the equations of motion are invariant on changes of sort of the background metric, the temperature scales this way, and the velocity scales that way. And the details of this are, it doesn't matter so much. Well, we'll come back and talk about it a little bit, but this makes it a conformal fluid. And so if you then work yourself in the regime of trace-free conformal fluids, you can consider, remember I said that the entropy flow there's some model dependence in it, right? So if that model dependence is going to be is going to work along with the trace-free conformal parts of it, then you're restricted in how the stress energy can be, well, if you've got a stress energy and your entropy flow, both of them will be restricted in how you can construct them, right? Because if you, let's just think about how we're going to do this now, right? So, okay, I guess what we're going to assume is we're sort of in a regime where it's a, you're in a fluid, right? And so things are sort of changing slowly. And so you do this derivative expansion, kind of a gradient expansion. And you can look at the different terms you can construct out of the, what you have. You have your U, you have your temperature, and I guess you've got your metric. That's basically what you got to work with. And so you look at the terms that you can construct, and so you have sort of, there's only a few first order terms, there's only a few second order terms, and so things that you calculate and things that you construct in physical quantities, if they're going to be conformally invariant, they've got to be sort of built out of these quantities, first order, second order, and so on. And so the idea is that any conformal field theory in the long wavelength limit would reduce to a trace-free conformal fluid. And I guess and that's sort of the basis of the fluid gravity correspondence. So the idea being that you have the full ADS-CFT correspondence holding in general, but you're in a regime, a near equilibrium regime, where you're in a long wavelength limit, and then your CFT just turns into a fluid. So we do that. And so now let's see how these things are actually constructed. And again, this will be fairly familiar to people who are in the talk. So if you have a boosted black brain space-time, this is a particular class of space-time. So this is essentially sort of a flat version of Schwarzschild in 5D, but we've got it, we've put a boost on it, again, like happened this morning. And so this here is, despite being messy, is a static solution at the moment. This is essentially like a Schwarzschild and a flat Schwarzschild in 5D with nothing happening. But we've boosted into a funny coordinate system. And so this is an exact static solution for constant T and U, and the ADS, this is an ADS solution, but the ADS radius is 1, and so the ADS, the cosmological constant is sort of hidden in this equation. So in this is a kind of editing Finkelstein-like, so lines of constant X and mu, so the X and mu parameterize these slices, right? So you think you've got a flat space-time, and you can sort of think of it as the horizon, well, you've got a sort of singularity at R equals 0, then you have all these other slices, R equals 1, R equals 2, and stuff moving out. R equals, the horizon is R equals pi times T, which is the temperature, and then you've got your other slices going on out. And so the line, and so these, those slices are parameterized by the X mu, and lines of constant X mu are ingoing null geodesics, and R is effectively is an affine parameter on those guys. So this is like an Eddington Finkelstein kind of solution. So that's an exact solution. And then the game that you play is you say, well, what about if we allow the quantities such as T and mu to vary slowly, sort of relative to the energy scale, which is fixed by the temperature here. And then you can perturbatively construct dynamical solutions in their gradient or the derivative expansion, right? And so again, the same game that gets usually played on this. So you do that. And so I'm skipping over all the details here. But I guess this first happened in this paper here, or I don't know, one of the early versions of it anyway. This particular one we're using, model showed up in this paper. So you do that, and so now I'm just writing down my metric, and all my new terms are, I'm just going to call them correction terms. I'm not going to write out the details here. So then the T and mu in the metric satisfy they're almost perfect fluid equations, and the corrections give you the dissipative terms. And so the mu in this metric, in the metric, it's sort of the direction of the boost, right, from the gravity side. But on the field theory side, if you calculate the stress energies involved here, the U is then the evolution vector for the fluid, and the T, which disappeared as a parameter in this equation, which told you where your horizon was, shows up as the temperature. And then the corrections here. So maybe I haven't said this exactly how it works. So what you do is you take your R equals constant surface, any R equals constant surface, it turns out, and you look at the metric imposed on that R equals constant surface, and then you go back to this Brown-York stress energy tensor, right? So you calculate the extrinsic curvature of these surfaces, and then you can construct things out of that. There's some details involved there, but you can construct a certain tensor out of that, which you can then interpret as the stress energy tensor of a perfect fluid. And to first order, it is you know, something times UU plus some P times the transverse metric, and plus there's some extra terms, small terms at the end, which are the dissipative terms where the energy is being worked from the viscosity. So, and again, I'm skipping all the details here. What you're saying then is that the perturbations from our original metric show up as basically as the extrinsic curvature of these surfaces in a particular combination, and those perturbations on the R equals constant surfaces obey Navier-Stokes. The fluid is usually deemed to live on the boundary, and I say deemed here because in fact these surfaces, you allow T and mu, they only depended on the X mu. They don't depend on R. So in fact, all of these surfaces, in some sense, there's only a trivial R dependence in this whole metric, right? So in some sense, there's not really much difference between R equals infinity and R closer in, right? It's all, because it's all, the same thing happens on every surface in terms of perturbations. It's just that the R is still having, like, the R shows up here and there, and that's the only place R shows up. It doesn't show up inside the perturbations. But from that point of view, what happens if you deem the fluid to live on the boundary, the conformal invariance of the fluid comes from the need, because you have to, of course, when R goes to infinity, you got your R squared out there, and this term would normally blow up, and so you have to conformally rescale to avoid this divergence, and that's sort of the root of the conformal invariance in the fluid from the relativist perspective. And so now you have a gravity theory, a particular metric, and you have some perturbations around that metric, and it matches up with, and then you have a fluid mechanics that is equivalent to it, and so then the argument is the thermodynamics on the two of them should match. And if the thermodynamics matches, then you're talking about the entropy matching up, and if the entropy is matching up, then you're talking about being able to pick out an area of a horizon, and so the question is this going to tell you where your horizon should be? So here we have, okay, so now, you're trying to locate your horizon. So you have your radial coordinate still, and the position of the horizon has got to be conformally invariant if it's going to be physically meaningful. And so you construct it out of these conformally invariant quantities, get everything kind of scaling in the right way, so these guys will scale oppositely from 1 over t, and so this will all kind of work out nicely. The evolution vector, you assume it's conformally invariant. These are sort of details of the calculation, but you construct things out of your conformally invariant quantities and then see which ones kind of satisfy the conditions that you want. So the conditions that you want is the event horizon must be null and asymptote to a final state. Of course, it's got to be null within the degree of the approximation, because these are all approximate solutions. You construct them order by order. And apparent horizon must have zero outward expansion. So in principle, what you do is you compare the expansions of these two surfaces, the entropy flow, and then you say, oh, the entropy is actually associated with the apparent horizon, not the event horizon, or oh, the other way around. But things aren't quite so simple. And so here's where the complications arrive. So the first complication is, of course, it's not just the event horizon. It's not just the horizon where there's a sort of entropy. It's the full space-time, right? I mean, so what's happening on the boundary is supposed to encompass the entire space-time. So the entropy should include the whole space-time. Now, you can make some kind of argument, and people do make the argument that what's happening on the horizon is going to be so much more important than what happens in the rest of the space-time that you can sort of assume, at least within the order of the approximation, that the entropy is just horizon-based. So we'll just go with that for now. Then the second question comes up is, how do you match what's happening in the bulk to what's happening in the boundary? So the obvious way to do it is do it on those V equals constant surfaces, right? And so you have those ingoing null geodesics, and that seems sort of a natural geometric way to associate things. But there's a little bit of freedom in how you do that. And so there's going to be some squishiness here in how you identify what's happening with the fluid with what's happening at particular spots in the bulk. But you've got more squishiness in lots of things, because the thermodynamics isn't uniquely defined in the fluid either. Because the entropy flow isn't uniquely picked out by the construction. You've got some freedom it comes from like picking an equation of state, I guess. An exact equation of state, and the equations of states, several of them will match your particular evolution, right? And so, because remember, these are all sort of approximate things. And so you've got some squishiness there in how you define your entropy flow. And then, you have to have entropy increasing. You have to have the divergence being non-zero, but it's not uniquely defined. So there's some freedom there as well. It's not a huge amount of freedom, but there's some freedom. And so, so it looks like you're not going to, well, you have to do the calculation, of course, but it looks like we're going to have some trouble because we've got uncertainty on one side and uncertainty on the other side. So your maybe your position that you might fall back to, your first fallback position would be if the uncertainties, and you're sort of thinking about maybe sort of having some sort of extra confirmation of this duality, right? Some kind of nice sort of second calculation that shows that the duality, the things work out, is perhaps the uncertainties match. So for example, one might hope that the uncertainty in defining the entropy flow will match up with the uncertainty in finding out the apparent horizons. And so now we're going to look at,
So can I say, so on the boundary you have a microscopic theory, so you can define the boundary, you can define entropy based on its microscopic definition. So what's wrong with that?
I think it's not unique. I think the prescription isn't not unique.
Why isn't it? I mean, you just count the states, like a statistical mechanics, you just count the states that...
I guess so. I guess we're thinking we're sort of in a completely classical situation. So we're thinking about classical thermodynamics, right? So you've got a classical fluid, and you're thinking about the thermodynamics of that fluid. So the sort of the standard prescription, like the Landau-Lifshitz prescription, is that there's a certain range of entropy currents that you can construct from that. It sort of corresponds to because you don't necessarily. So the temperature and the entropy are sort of things that sort of fit in there on top of it, right? You have these extra things get added in. And there's different ways. There's not a unique way to add them in.
So, I can imagine that there's more than one current that increases, has positive divergence. But then we have a specific definition, like TdS is dE plus PdV. So why couldn't you just use that?
Let's just think how it would work, right? So I guess you're going to have your equation of state in there, right? You got to work out how you're going to you got your equation of state. You're going to have to work out your temperature as kind of a freely defined field in some sense, right? And that, I mean, if you're just sort of constructing your possible theories, right? And so you've got different temperatures that could go in there. You've got different dissipative terms that are going to show up, right? It depends on exactly how you construct your theory, and this whole thing's in an approximation.
So that's true. That dissipative terms, so that it's hard to include that mindset. I agree with that.
Yeah. And so, it's selected to some extent, right? There's a little bit of freedom in exactly how you do it. I mean, it's not like you can say anything, right? Maybe I don't know if I claim it's almost anything there. I say almost any, that's an exaggeration. It's selected up to terms of the order of the expansion, the first order is, if you're doing the first order, it's selected up to like first order.
I just think like entropy of the gas in this room, there isn't really much ambiguity in characterizing it, but maybe you're talking about like very strongly coupled situations where there is some ambiguity. But I mean, like in weakly coupled situations, there isn't much ambiguity.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll look at this one particular example to start out, which is sort of a test case, because it's the easy one to do, Bjorken flow. So here, basically, you have a gas that's sort of uniformly expanding in all directions. And this is, this was one of the motivations that why people were interested in these things, because they're hoping to say things about quark gluon plasmas. But I was the tame relativist on it, so I'm not going to say much about that except put a picture in there, try to brighten up the slide a bit. So you have a 4D flow. So we're looking at we're thinking about what's happening on the boundary here now, and your fluid on the boundary is sort of expanding uniformly in all directions. So when I say planar symmetry, I really mean 3D planar symmetry. And so when you set things up this way, it turns out you've got all variables depend on the proper time alone. So your energy density, your entropy, your these are sort of first order, right? Your temperature. The perturbed Brewster black plane is kind of looks like the one we had there. And it turns in this case that when you work out the details of the construction, the symmetry, of course, if you assume the symmetry also holds in the bulk, then a unique apparent horizon is selected. So the way you think about that is that in an apparent horizon, like a marginally trapped surface or whatever, if you think about what happens in sort of the Vidya space-time, if you demand that you only look for spherically symmetric surfaces, horizons, then there's a unique apparent horizon as well. So we're using you're using sort of symmetry to select out a particular one. But it turns out that when you use that symmetry, it doesn't kill off your freedom in your entropy flow on the fluid side. So the conclusion from that is the apparent horizon of certainty is not the same thing as the entropy flow freedom in constructing the entropy vector. Okay, so then you can actually just calculate these things. And so to lowest order, I guess I use epsilon in two different ways here, right? Here, this is the expansion parameter, which isn't necessarily the same thing as the energy density. It isn't the same thing as energy density. So you have your surface gravity, this is to lowest order. Your first law sort of holds, right? So you work out your shears and everything, things kind of fit working reasonably nicely there. And then you look at your entropies. And so here, for the fluid, you can you calculate it all out, and it turns out that the uncertainties show up at second order. These are the possible sort of conformally invariant entropy flow vectors that you can choose. For the apparent horizon, it comes out this way. This is for the one that's selected by the symmetries, and this is the event horizon. And so what you see here is that of course, we have some uncertainty of constants here. But basically, things match up at first order, at zeroth order. They match up at first order. It's at second order that uncertainties start to show up. But these are all sort of reasonably, so you've got your apparent horizon is the entropy smaller than for the event horizon, which is what you expect, because the event horizon had better be outside the apparent horizon, because the way the theorems work. And then you have this constant beta, which is a free constant, and you're sort of on the same order as these guys, right? And this is freely defined, so you could pick beta equal to sort of like 4 and a bit, or almost 5, I guess, and you get your apparent horizon, you pick equal to 7, and you get your event horizon. And this beta is basically a free quantity as long as it's not too big. So it's not going to blow up this term, higher than the first order, so it's going to keep it at second order. So within this particular example of Bjorken flow, the fluid entropy, the allowed entropies in the fluid could match either the apparent or the event horizon. Okay, so that's just what I say down there. So of course, this is like the super high symmetry case, right? So this is sort of like when you're doing, if you're doing calculations with Vidya or some many exact solutions, you can do the calculations, but they're so simple that sometimes you lose things because it's just not enough to see. So we want to go to a more general case. So this is basically the slide I had before. And so we got the same things, but we're going to do it for a more general solution now. So instead of going to Bjorken flow, we'll kind of go to the general five-dimensional black brain. And we're going to fix a particular bulk boundary map. Right, so we're going to fix the V equals constant map, saying what's happening in the box, saying what's happening in the boundary. So you do that, and it turns out that you both get a preferred event horizon and a preferred apparent horizon. So up to second order, at least, it turns out there's only one surface that matches the possible things to become an event horizon and the possible things to become an apparent horizon. And so what happens is the teleological stuff is coming in here, is that you're assuming that we're assuming that we're in a perturbed situation, and we're assuming that we're going to be in a perturbed situation forever. So we're assuming that at no point is there going to become a massive a pulse of energy going to come in and disrupt everything. And so that condition is sufficient to tell us that then you look for null surfaces that are close to r equals 1 over pi t, right, which was where the horizon would be in equilibrium. And it turns out there's only one null surface that satisfies that. And the way you sort of see that is most null surfaces will either diverge out to infinity pretty quickly or diverge in, and there's only sort of one that sort of hangs in there close to r equals 1 over pi t. So it turns out that, and this is essentially because we're close to equilibrium, right? We're only working in a perturbative thing. So in some of the papers you read about this, they talk about these the locally defined event horizons, and in some sense they are locally defined, but it's important to remember that they're only locally defined because you've made some global assumptions about possible behaviors. Then the apparent horizon, which is from these papers that we did, I think we go to second order, I don't remember exactly now. And it turns out there's only one theta L equals zero surface satisfying the conditions as well. So the second order conformal invariance also selects a unique horizon. It's unclear whether this is true at higher orders. I have my doubts. I don't think it probably is. I think this is also probably because we're in close to equilibrium. So I think this is an equilibrium behavior. Michael and Michael, my collaborators, were sort of hopeful that this might be true to all orders, but we never pushed, they never pushed the calculation high enough to see, and so I don't know. We'll see. Okay, so we're moving along pretty well here now. So we've got an apparent horizon and an event horizon again there, right? And we've got unique ones, and so we can compare it with our fluid entropy, right? Here, the fluid entropy flow. And so again, we kind of construct things within the parameters that were allowed, making sure things are conformally invariant and seeing how it all works out. Okay. And so, and if you do that, and I haven't got it up here at the moment, it turns out that again, the possible freedom in the entropy flow vector encompasses both the apparent and the event horizon. And so what's actually the case is that if you're trying to measure the entropy of the fluid, you can't actually distinguish between the apparent and the event horizon. They're essentially, you know, you're down at second order, right? So you might even say, think that for thermodynamics, you should only be even thinking about what's happening at first order. And so it's sort of lost down in the details, the difference between the apparent and the event horizons, partially because they're so close together, right? So when I say up this one, my sort of super title up there is Embrace the Uncertainties. This says that, well, maybe when you're close to equilibrium in this situation and you think about horizons, it doesn't make sense to say it's got to be one or the other. Maybe this sort of fuzziness that's coming in, because we're in a dynamical situation here, right? So entropy, there's going to be some uncertainties in how you define it, right? Especially as things start moving faster. Maybe what you should say is that we know what happens in equilibrium, and if we're out of equilibrium just a little bit, the whole notions are going to become, it's going to become fuzzy. Exactly what you say is the exact entropy and so on. And that's what you're going to do. So we have this idea of phenomenological horizon. So this isn't so different from what happens, say, in the membrane paradigm, where you basically think of your physics as on the time-like boundary just outside the event horizon, or time-like surface outside the event horizon. Okay, so let's think about kind of things that you could say were a horizon, right? So you'd want them, from the point of view of entropy and thermodynamics, you'd want them to reduce the universal horizon equilibrium, right, the static one. You want them to form a causal barrier, because it's not much of a horizon if things can get out of it, and you want them to be expanding. Just like how the Landau-Lifshitz description for talking about the entropy of a fluid flow is that it be the divergence be non-zero. And so you can, if you set this up, and so you can sort of set these things up mathematically, but I'm not giving the details because they're messy. You can set it up so it includes both apparent and event horizon, includes possible things how you usually do for the membrane paradigm. And you also sort of require things to be near equilibrium, and all these quantities can be, all these things can be quantified. And so, let's see what we've got here. I think maybe I don't need to say too much exactly how it is, but it turns out that when you do all these calculations, you set things up, then sort of within the orders of the approximation that you're working in, to first order, the apparent and the event horizons are indistinguishable, and in fact, they both match up what the freedom of the entropy flow. But then when you go to second order, the divergences between the differences between them, they show up at second order, but again, those differences are all encompassed inside the entropy flow. And so I think that's probably my last, I guess I got my summary now. So usually at the end of my talks, I include a few pictures of Newfoundland. And so this is one of them, and there'll be a couple more this time for reasons that you'll see in a second. This is a picture my dad took actually a few years ago of an iceberg. So if you're not paying attention at all, you can just admire the iceberg now and think, oh, damn, the stuff is covering up it, so I can't see it now. But anyway, so here's our summary of the results. To lowest order, fluid thermodynamics matches horizon mechanics for all horizons. So at that level, the horizons are indistinguishable, right, beyond at first order, and the things you'd expect for the fluid mechanics match up. Fluid gravity doesn't favor either of these. The freedom encompasses both of them. The hope that several people have expressed at different times is that maybe the freedom in defining the entropy current can be attributed to the ambiguity in locating apparent horizons. That's not the case. Instead, it can be equally well attributed to either of. Now, I didn't actually say much about this. If you think about this more general definition of horizons, that's one way of setting it with freedom. But it turns out if you look at the ambiguities in how you're going to match the bulk to the boundary, the horizon to the boundary, there's also a sort of equivalent freedom there. So at the level of identifying what's happening, the from the point of view of the fluid, it's for the fluid actually, because of this horizon boundary thing, couldn't actually distinguish between the horizons because there's an ambiguity in how you match up what's happening at the horizon and what's happening up at the boundary. And so these are two freedoms that are basically of the same size. And so that sort of suggests that at this level, it probably doesn't even make sense to talk about which one you're talking about, whether you're talking about the event or apparent horizon in the thermodynamics, because you're in this near equilibrium regime where everything's so close and you can't distinguish between them. Do I have another point there? Yeah, okay. But at second order, you do get a favored apparent horizon, which is maybe a little bit of a surprise. So here are concerns from a relative perspective. One concern, of course, actually, when this picture was taken was I was afraid my son Emmett here was going to go over the rocks and crack his skull open because he's kind of clumsy. But he didn't. Another concern might be that this picture was taken in late August, and there's still quite a lot of icebergs around, right? So, but anyway, that's not what we're concerned about here. So here's the relativist perspective on this calculation, which is, you know, my perspective. How do the boundary perturbations? Okay, so when you talk about the Navier-Stokes equations being this, this is simply, this is what actually be true on any surface. So if you calculate the extrinsic curvatures and you define the stress energy from those extrinsic curvatures, this will hold for any surface, and it's just Gauss-Kadatsky. The Gauss-Kadatsky equations tell you this is true. This is a geometric identity. So your equations of motion, finding that your fluid or your supposed fluid on a boundary matches these equations of motion, isn't a surprise because it's got to happen that way geometrically. That's just Gauss-Kadatsky equations. So what you're really talking about is if you're thinking about kind of being further from equilibrium, you can still calculate all these things on the boundary. And the question is, what is this kind of fluid or whatever on the boundary, right? And when you're talking about whether it's a fluid, it's basically whether it takes the form PUU plus pressure times the transverse metric, plus maybe corrections, right? And so it'd be nice to see, so this is the opposite perspective, right? So the way these calculations happen, and the way the talk went this morning, right, was you start off with the fluid, and you go back and construct the gravity on the other side. And you start off with 4D on the fluid, because of course, you know, the world is four dimensions, and then you just want to understand what the gravity corresponds to this. But of course, I'm a relativist. So for me, I'm more interested in a 4D gravity and a 3D bulk, because for me, the world is 4D, and I'm on the gravity side. And so what you'd like to see here is, well, what I'd like to see is how, if you start out with a regular four-dimensional, ADS black hole, I guess, and you look at the perturbations there, what does that tell you? How does that always work for the fluid? And so, I'll just jump down to here. I say, how general is the fluid gravity correspondence? Because what's happened here, and what the focus of most papers is, you construct the fluid solution, and then you say, oh yeah, there's a gravity solution that goes with this. But it's not generally been shown in the opposite way as well, right? Because if you start with a general gravity solution, we don't have the way to go directly to fluid in the opposite direction. It's sort of widely believed, and I think I believe that it's going to happen as well, but we haven't seen exactly the mechanism of how that happens. My other concern, and anyone who's in the talk this morning will remember me keeping on asking questions about this because that was on my mind, these 5D black brain solutions, they're kind of weird, right? Because like I said, the only error dependence is that initial trivial error dependence. All the perturbations are only in sort of like the x, y, z, and t direction. There's no perturbations in the error direction. So in fact, even though we talk about what's happening at infinity, it doesn't actually even really come into what the thing doesn't have to be infinity. All r equals constant surfaces are essentially equivalent in this case. Okay, that's what I've got on that. So now I've just got a little promotional slide. So next summer in St. John's, we're having the Canadian GR meeting from July 10th to 12th. And probably most people don't know, there's this famous picture of a little kid standing here between these two codfish that were caught in Battle Harbor in Labrador in 1911. So we just stuck Einstein in there instead for a poster. And then associated with this, and I discovered something. If you start taking Einstein and photoshopping him into pictures, you can waste a lot of time doing that. Because almost any picture can be improved and made funny by sticking Einstein in it. And As I was making this one, my wife was saying to me, because I had all kinds of things here, she said, oh, this is a really useful way to use, this is a productive use of your time, Ivan. But anyway, so I got this one. And then this is from our holiday this summer, which was in Newfoundland, and sort of another promotional thing for people who might come to the Canadian GR. You can see like Gros Morne, again, those are those icebergs. This is up in Battle Harbour, there's whales, there's lighthouses. This was an extremely windy day. It was extremely easy to fly a kite here. You just sort of threw it up in the air and it was gone. Sorry, that's a couple of pictures from Newfoundland. So that's it. Yeah?
So my understanding is this ambiguity in the entropy, correct?
Yeah.
From the fact that you're not picking a particular microscopic theory, you're just looking sort of at generically.
Yes,
subject to these conformal type conditions. Yeah. So if you had in mind a particular microscopic theory and a particular entropy current, could you then say, well, this theory, you know, the fluid gravity thing only works if you pick the event, you know, that would single out the event horizon versus the apparent horizon?
Yeah, I think I possibly, but my suspicion is what would happen is you would pick a theory and it probably would, I doubt it would be either. Right? It would probably fall within this range. It would probably be somewhere in between, is my guess.
Oh, I see. So you had this particular coefficient, I think it was beta.
Yeah.
And you said 5 was this theory.
So I think particular theories would select particular values of beta.
Yeah.
And just out of guess, I'd say you probably wouldn't be lucky enough to hit one of them. Well, maybe you would, right? But I mean, I guess at the classical level, at this level where you're looking at these things, right, those theories are all sort of indistinguishable, right? It would be more or less indistinguishable. And so I guess, yeah, if you pick a particular one, I guess it would give you a particular entropy. It might or might not match, I guess. I guess if you cleverly picked it, it would match one of them, I guess. Would be my take on it, yeah.
So you said a couple of times the map between the bulk and boundary was ambiguous. So could you, why was that again?
Let me see if I can remember now.
I was just a bit surprised by that.
I guess, let's think how it would work. So I guess what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to decide how if you're sitting at infinity and you're sending light rays in, you've got to decide the details of exactly how you're going to do that. And I think if you don't have any perturbation, it's all stationary, I think it's unambiguous. I don't quite remember the details of exactly how this works, but if you start going into a dynamical situation, it's just not, you've got some freedom in how you pick it. And that's essentially what it is. It depends on how you choose to send your light rays in, which are then going to match up to what's happening. I don't remember the details of that, but I think that basically helps.
Is there an off-weight let us sum this figure in?